brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
The late Tony Schwartz created commercials for more than 400 corporations, 5 presidential campaigns, and countless social causes. Hailed as a guru of the newly emerging electronic media by Marshall McLuhan, he taught media studies at New York University, Harvard, Columbia, and Fordham. In 2007, the Library of Congress acquired Schwartz's entire body of work. It took 3 large truckloads. Bill Moyers has said of him, "He was a genius in his understanding of the communications revolution of the 20th century." And Moyers further added that his interview with Tony Schwartz was one of his favorites and one of the most important in his long career in broadcast journalism. Tony Schwartz came to understand at the most microscopic level how we all rely on media to communicate. We all live in a media space, but few of us can see it. With his profoundly penetrating view, Schwartz helps us to see how our modern media environment works on us and in us. Today, we'll be visiting with Tony Schwartz's surviving son, jazz musician Anton Schwartz, as we explore the legacy of his father. Our conversation will center around the second edition of the seminal book on media, The Responsive Chord, How Media Manipulates You, What You Buy, Who You Vote For, and How You Think, with our guest, Anton Schwartz. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Anton, welcome.
It's such a pleasure to be here, Justine.
It's a pleasure to have you. Let's just go back. Let's see, your father passed on in what,
2008.
And let's go back and help our listeners know a little bit of his background, his early background. It was so fascinating. We're talking about the 1940s, and he is walking around New York City with a recording device that he's made. It was before there were any portable recording devices, and he made one. And talk about what he was doing as he was walking around.
Yeah, he was just fascinated with sound and with music and with all kinds of sounds that many people would consider just noise. You know, the sounds of the city. He was interested in brilliant things that people had to say, as well as just everyday things that they would say. He was interested in nursery rhymes and jump rope songs, and he made a bunch of albums about that contained conversations with people around the city. One of conversations with taxi cab drivers, and others with that would focus on the sounds of the Puerto Rican immigration to New York. The sounds of children, and so on. It was his obsession. As a result, he would hear things in a way that, at the same time, in the way that everyone would hear them, because he was listening to the everyday things of life. You know, he wasn't seeking the most incredible garbage truck sound. He would record these things in their context, but at the same time, present them in a way that people could hear them with new ears to hear them. So yes, like you say, he bought a tape recorder and built it into a briefcase. He made a battery for the electronics of it and built a flywheel mechanism to operate the mechanics of it. And he took the view meter that shows you the level of the sound and brought it up to the outside where he cut a hole in the suitcase. And then he would feed the microphone cord through his jacket and his shirt so that he could hold on to the recorder with one hand and have the microphone in his other hand. And he would often have it sort of hidden under his sleeve. So he could just sort of point his hand at someone and they knew they were being recorded if they were speaking, but they wouldn't be so aware of the process, which at that point was so alien, you know. These days, everyone's out there with their cell phone, you know, video recording and stuff. But back then, you know, people didn't do that. It didn't even exist, the technology.
And then those recordings got made into many albums by Folkway Music or records, Folkway Records, right?
Yeah, exactly. There was about a dozen of them.
Right, right.
On different subjects.
Fascinating, fascinating. And then at some point, he got into advertising. So what was the segue of that? How did that happen for him?
The segue was interesting. He had a reputation for recording all kinds of things, among them children. He had a real reputation for recording children. And he had a radio show, a weekly program on WNYC. He used to do nightclub acts and so on, in which he would play recordings and tell stories. And so word kind of got around, and Johnson & Johnson approached him about doing advertisements, which he had never done, advertisements specifically for Johnson's baby powder. And they were interested in using children the way he had used children. So he thought that was an interesting problem.
And at that point, if children were being recorded, they would substitute a woman's voice imitating children.
Exactly. He was the first person to ever make ads using real children. Until then, you would have specially devoted female actresses to voiceover people who did their career as children, you know, portraying children.
Right, right. So, I think we need to. So this starts him in all of this, and one of the most famous. He has many famous ads, but one of the most famous we'll have to say something about is, we call it the Daisy ad.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me, and I'll have you describe it in a moment, but it's interesting to me that it only aired one time. That was it. But the impact of that ad just continues to reverberate this day. So describe that particular ad.
The ad, it shows a little girl. And she's in a field, and it's a very pastoral scene, and she has a daisy in front of her.
And it's black and white,
isn't it? It is black and white,
yeah.
This was 1964 for the Johnson campaign. And we hear her picking the petals off the daisy and counting and doing it in a somewhat haphazard way, counting up, you know, one, two, three, four. And as she finally gets to approach 10, two things happen. First of all, the camera pans quickly, or I should say zooms into her pupil. It zooms into her face and then into her pupil, and black eventually covers the screen. And simultaneous to that, we hear an ominous countdown voice, 10, 9, 8, 7. And when it gets down past 1, we see a nuclear explosion. And then the only words that are pronounced are that of President Johnson, actually quoting the poet W.H. Auden in a message about how important it is to love each other, or we will go into the darkness. It's an extremely positive message, you know, in the context of the threat of nuclear war. And it's an unusual thing because it's hailed as the grandfather of all negative advertising, and yet it has neither of the essential qualities of negative ads, which are that, you know, it's all about accusing the mentioning the opponent and accusing them of things, and, you know, carrying a negative message. He to his dying day, you know, he fought that term negative ad, because the message is entirely positive, and, you know, we must love each other.
So this brings to mind really the basis of all of his work. And the basis of his work is that he understood that any kind of message like this does not stand alone as content, like directed at us, but it's like the viewer is bringing something to it. This is where the responsive chord comes, so the responsive resonance. Tell us about this.
You've totally got it. I mean, as we all grow up reading textbooks, we grow up being taught things where the teacher says something and then we're responsible for remembering it. We grow up reading books where our notion of what it means to convey a message is that someone knows something and then they transmit the message to someone else, and then now the other person knows something. And it's a way of thinking about communication that was very appropriate with books, because when you wrote a book, you wouldn't know who was going to read it. You would try to make it as, you know, factual and general, of course, if it's nonfiction, as factual and general as you could. And then the recipient would have all this time to ponder it over and figure out what is the information that's contained in this. And, you know, how do I learn? But it's very different with modern media. And just like you say, it all happens so quickly that we don't have this long time of pondering and parsing and trying to understand the knowledge. We react very immediately to the messages that we get in over TV, now over the internet. And it's often at a very subconscious level. And so in this case, you know, the opponent was never mentioned, right? This was an ad. It was an ad for President Johnson against Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater's name was never mentioned in the ad. And if you played it to someone today who didn't know about the campaign and mentioned Barry Goldwater, they would ask, what does he have to do with the whole thing? But for the listener at that time, they knew that Barry Goldwater had talked about using tactical nuclear weapons for deforestation in Vietnam, that he had joked about, you know, spoken lightly of using nuclear weapons. That was very much in the public mind, in the zeitgeist. And so for the 1964 listener to see this ad that was just talking about the importance of peace and anti-nuclear sentiment, they thought, wow, you know, this is really important. Right. Do I want Barry Goldwater's finger on the trigger?
I'm here with Anton Schwartz, and he is the son of Tony Schwartz. And there's a new reissuing, a second edition of Tony Schwartz's book, The Responsive Chord, How Media Manipulates You, What You Buy, Who You Vote For, and How You Think. And if you want to know more about the work of Anton Schwartz, you can go to his website, antonjazz.com. Anton is a jazz musician by trade and by avocation and vocation, I'm assuming. And if you want to know more about his father's work, go to tonyschwartz.org. Or you can give there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Anton Swartz, and he's the son of the media genius and philosopher of the new communications environment, Tony Schwartz, who was the author of The Responsive Chord, How Media Manipulates You, What You Buy, Who You Vote For, and How You Think. And there's a new edition of this book that's recently out. Anton, I would like to ask you to go back to the idea of the new communications environment. There used to be, when it was print, or let's say before telephones, it took time and space that went to communicate. But now everything, even more so now, it's instantaneous. It happens like immediately. And I know that your father really talked about how that Daisy commercial that he did, some people would say, oh, that was very manipulative. And he himself would never describe it as that. He would say, no, it's participatory.
He even liked to use the word partipulation.
Partipulation. What did he mean by that?
Where he meant that, it isn't a sort of manipulation, but what it is the manipulation is the process of the message interacting with the listener, and even more so, the listener is an active participant in, you know, the creation of the message by how they respond to it, by what, you know, assumptions and emotions and knowledge they bring to the table. So, you know, it's manipulation of a sort in that you're reacting, you're putting a message out there that reacts with the listener's feelings and understanding and knowledge. But the listener is an active participant in this process.
They're the ones that bring the meaning to it.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, he's not feeding the meaning to them.
Right.
But it seems as if it's happening that way. But actually, as you're saying it, that there's something that's coming forward from the viewer, listener.
Right. And the listener is an essential element in the creation of the meaning of the ad or the message or whatever the form of communication
is. In his particular ads, I mean, I know I watch ads just for their cultural meaning, so to speak, to watch them, to just see, you know, I mostly fast forward through them. I DVR everything, you know, so I have the privilege of fast forwarding, but I might see an image or something and I'll say, okay, I'm going to watch this because I think that there's some cultural information that's happening through advertising. Mm-hmm. And some of them, Anton, I look at it and I just shake my head. I say, how stupid do they think we are? You know, they're just silly and stupid. And I don't understand why they even put them on. Maybe they work in some way. I don't know. But then there are those that come on that really get me. All right, I'll give you an example of one. I'll give you an example of two.
Terrific.
One that gets me, that I guess it elicits my meaning, and these are the Subaru ads. And they this is for a car, and they elicit about family, protection, the longevity of the car that it lasts through a whole generation, and you know, dogs grow up and pass on, and kids go to college, and it's just I love the stories of them, and I remember their Subarus, and I have a very positive sort of feeling about that. So that's a kind of ad that pulls meaning from me. It might not for other people. Then there's another ad that I see, and I'd like to ask you about this one because I don't quite understand it. It's very provocative. It's visually riveting. And this is the Lincoln ads with Matthew McConaughey. And it just he's so good. They just every little nuance of his face, kind of a smirk or a kind of self-satisfaction or whatever it is that he's conveying is great, and the visuals are extraordinary. His driving his Lincoln, but it doesn't elicit anything out of me other than just fascination to to look at him mm-hmm. and to look at the visuals of the ad. It doesn't do anything emotionally for me. So do you have any comment about these two?
Yeah, well, I must say I've seen ads like the Subaru ad for sure. I don't think I've seen the Matthew McConaughey ad. The only time I actually see television is when I'm at the gym mm-hmm. because I don't watch it at home. But it's clear that the Subaru ad has tapped into some very deep feelings of yours and of, we can assume, of many, many other people. You know, probably not going to hit to the core of what's making a young millennial seek a car, right? You know, there's probably other demographics where the relevant features of a car would be the social perception, speed, adventurousness, right? Quite the opposite. You know, even something that, you know, you can just burn through and move on to the next great thing rather than holding on to for and passing down to your children. I would guess that, you know, the advertisers have done a good job of targeting, you know, the shows that you like to mm-hmm. watch. And as far as the other ad, you know, that's the thing, is that it may well strike a chord with other viewers.
Right.
And I don't know in particular what that would be. And, you know, it's one of these things where if you're not in the target audience, you may be left scratching your head. Of course, there's also the possibility that it's just a bad ad that is, you know, that is a beautifully made thing that just doesn't reach anyone. My dad made very, very inexpensive, clean, simple, inexpensive ads that would convey the message. And he'd often get the job done more successfully than, you know, agencies that had 100 times the budget.
He did. That reminds me of an ad that he did. It was like for tobacco, to quit smoking. I think the American Cancer Society.
Yeah. It was the very first anti-smoking ad on television.
Describe that ad.
Yeah. The ad is, all it is two children playing. I can't remember the year, but it's certainly the 60s, if not the late 50s. It must have been in the 60s. And it was two children just going through their parents' bedroom, going through their closet, pulling out clothes, playing and saying, you know, oh, do I look like mama now? And the girl, it's a boy and a girl, and the girl is putting on lipstick and dressing up in a huge dress that's way over her size, but to look like mom, and the little kid has his dad's jacket on. And the most of it, there's no music, there's no voiceover, except for the kids occasionally saying something. And then at the end, it's a voiceover, and I wish I could remember the precise words, but it's a voiceover saying, children love to imitate their parents. Do you smoke?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it's not telling, my dad used to say, don't should on me, right?
Yes.
And, you know, you should do this, you should do this. And by that, he meant, you know, if you're trying to convey a message, don't tell me what to do. Make me feel what needs to be done. Make me come to my own conclusion. And if I do that, you know, in this participation between what you're telling me and what I already feel, or what you're showing me and what I already feel, if you evoke the response, and the response that he wanted in this case is, yeah, wow, I better not smoke because I don't want my children to smoke and they're going to have me as their model.
And it was very effective. I mean, it changed the tobacco industry in some ways.
They voluntarily stopped advertising as a result, because they could see the, you know, the writing on the walls.
And this is just, again, he was such a master in doing some of this stuff, just way out ahead of the curve. I've read that even the Obama administration, they all, the people that worked on the campaign when he was running for president, that they all had their people read the response of Cord. You know, that was like mandatory reading.
I have heard that through a couple of sources through the grapevine. I haven't actually been able to confirm that. What I do know is that the media person for Joe Biden was a great disciple of my dad's, mm-hmm. a man named Joe Slade White. And Karl Rove actually is on the record saying that my Dad's book is one of the most important. Well,
right. So, I mean, from the whole spectrum, political spectrum, people can tap into it. And I know that there was something else that your father did, and that was when people would do, when advertising agencies would have focus groups, and they would say, okay, how are you going to react to this ad? And they would ask questions that would talk about the content and how someone would remember what the content was. Your father went at it a very different way. He never really did that. Do you recall how he did
that? Yeah, absolutely. He wasn't interested in many of the metrics that were popular in the advertising world at the time. You know, how well can the audience remember the name? How well can they remember the slogan? You know, was the slogan this or this or this? He was interested much more in what he would call pre-search rather than research after the fact. He would spend the money for research before the ad to try to find out what opinions the audience, the target audience had already, how they already thought about things, what their associations were, so that he could tap into that to get the message across properly. Because you can't have a proper participatory interaction with the viewer that has a predictable outcome unless you really understand certain things about the viewer.
I was also struck by the idea that he would have open-ended questions, so to speak, rather than check this box and they're already filled out the answer and you check the one that's most appropriate for you. But it would be a question about how did you feel about this and let them come up with whatever information they had in their own words. And then he would categorize those in different categories.
Exactly, exactly. To try to get a really broad sense of aspects of the listener, the viewer's knowledge and emotions and what they were bringing to the table that isn't neatly categorizable.
It just occurs to me in this most recent election, you know, the polls were just weird. There were some that said, that Trump is going to win, and some that said Clinton is going to win, and they were just so miles apart. And I'm just wondering if that was part of it, that these some of the poll takers just weren't really eliciting the true pulse of what was going on.
Yeah, it's true. My dad was very aware of certain things. He would make sure if he were doing a political ad and if there were a photo of a ballot booth or, you know, something like that, a depiction of the voting process, he would make sure to have the names listed in exactly the same order that they were going to be on the ballot. He would make sure that they would be in the same font so that it would be very predictive of future.
Excellent,
behavior.
Excellent. I'm here with Anton Schwartz, and he is the son of Tony Schwartz, who is the author of The Responsive Chord. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Anton Schwartz, and he's the son of the now deceased Tony Schwartz, who was a media genius, a philosopher of the new communication environment, and the author of the now